I think U.S. versus Clark.
U.S. versus Clark. I'm sorry. Unless you trade places, I guess, if you wanted to.
Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning, Counsel. May it please the Court, my name is Brad Andreazzi, and I represent Defendant Appellant Ricky Clark. I'd like to focus in the time available on two primary reasons why the District Court's judgment should be reversed and rest on the briefs on the other arguments unless there are questions. The first reason for reversal is the constitutional reason. Clark had a Fifth and Sixth Amendment right to require the government to prove drug quantity to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt. Then that is because the finding of drug quantity here exposed Clark to a higher sentencing range. It increased the maximum penalty to which he was exposed from 20 years to life imprisonment, as well as triggering a mandatory minimum sentence under the statute. Now, the district court ultimately sentenced Clark to 10 years of imprisonment, but it's important to realize that the court did not think that this was an appropriate sentence for Clark. In fact, the district court had originally sentenced Clark to 48 months in considering the factors of his long history of gainful employment, his lack of any significant criminal history, and evidence of good character. The district court felt compelled to resentence Clark based on opinions of this court finding no Apprendi right where judicial fact-finding triggers a mandatory minimum. Just as the district court felt bound by precedents of this court to impose a sentence that the district court believed was unjust and unconstitutional, this court has felt bound by the Supreme Court's decision in Harris, as this court has broadly interpreted that decision, to reject constitutional challenges to judicial fact-finding that trigger statutory mandatory minimum penalties. And yet this court has noticed in cases such as Jones and Duncan that other Supreme Court cases seem to have undermined the reasoning of Harris.
There's a threshold question before we get to the merits of the constitutional arguments that you've raised that I'd like you to address regarding the procedural propriety of the resentencing in the first place.
I'd be delighted, Your Honor. The court, as I mentioned, originally sentenced Clark to 4 years. And that sentence was based upon the government's position, both before sentencing, in responding to Clark's sentencing memo, and at sentencing, that there was no mandatory minimum sentence that applied. At the sentencing hearing, indeed, the court asked the assistant U.S. attorney directly, is there a mandatory minimum? And the AUSA said, there is not, Judge. And the government simply recommended a sentence within the guideline range. The court relied upon that. After the sentence was invoked, the government, after the sentence was issued, the government invoked Rule 35A. It is our position that that was an incorrect vehicle because the government had waived any right to insist upon the 10-year sentence by its conduct at a sentencing
hearing. Can you let an incorrect sentence go?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Can you let an incorrect sentence go?
Well, that's exactly right, Your Honor. You can, and this court has said so in the Byerly case that we cite in the briefs. Byerly is very close to the decision here, the situation here. In Byerly, at sentencing, the assistant U.S. attorney was asked by the court, does the mandatory minimum in the guidelines apply? The guidelines were then mandatory. And the assistant U.S. attorney said, no, Your Honor. It was a straddle offense, and there was the issue of whether the mandatory minimum applied, given that the alleged conspiracy had started before the effective date. This court in Byerly said that as a matter of law, the AUSA's response to the court at sentencing was incorrect. And this court also went further and said the sentence that was actually imposed was illegal. And yet the court said that the sentence could not be corrected under the predecessor of Rule 35A, which actually had much broader authority than the current rule.
Isn't there some kind of an inherent inconsistency in this idea of waiver of something under Rule 35? Rule 35 assumes that somebody made a mistake, right? Or you wouldn't have to correct the sentence.
If
you make a mistake, that's a waiver, according to your theory. So,
well, Your Honor,
whatever use do you get out of Rule 35 if if you're going to say any mistake is a waiver.
Well, Your Honor, Rule 35 doesn't say that.
And in this case, the AUSA made a mistake. He answered the question incorrectly. So they're trying to get it changed by Rule 35, but you're saying, well, that mistake was a waiver. So,
well, Your Honor, Rule 30.
Inherent problem with that theory?
Rule 35 doesn't exist to correct any mistake or to rectify any waiver. The rule only allows the correction of a sentence resulting from arithmetical, technical, or other clear error. And the advisory committee notes are very explicit. They say the authority of the rule is very narrow. It doesn't allow a party to reopen issues that were resolved at the sentencing hearing or relax the requirement to state all objections at the sentencing hearing. And indeed, in Peretta, this court said that using Rule 35A to raise an objection abandoned at the sentencing hearing is patently improper.
Would it be different if the government had just overlooked the mandatory minimum as opposed to having stated affirmatively on the record it does not apply? Then would Rule 35 kick in?
It might, Your Honor. It might. Because the situation then would not be on all fours with Byerly. In Byerly, as here, the assistant U.S. attorney actually informed the court incorrectly, in the court's view in Byerly, that the mandatory minimum was discretionary. And this court said, notwithstanding that the sentence was illegal, the government was bound by the representations of its agent at the sentencing hearing. So the situation, the hypothetical that you suggest, might indeed be a different situation. But on the authority of Byerly, it is our position that the government could not properly use Rule 35A here. Turning back, if there are no further questions on that, turning back to the constitutional issue, we recognize that this court has felt bound by Harris as it has interpreted Harris. But our submission is that Harris doesn't apply in the situation here where judicial fact-finding substitutes a new sentencing range with an increased maximum as well as an increased minimum penalty. That wasn't the situation in Harris. As the court, I'm sure, realizes, in Harris, the judicial fact-finding that the Supreme Court allowed had no effect on the statutory maximum, and indeed only a very modest effect on the minimum penalty. In addition, Harris was a decision of a divided Supreme Court. The language that this court and others have relied upon for a broad interpretation of Harris is in Part 3 of Justice Kennedy's plurality opinion, and four justices flatly rejected that view. And a fifth justice, Justice Breyer, concurred in the judgment, but said that he thought that there was no way in terms of logic to distinguish Harris from Apprendi. And so he disagreed with the plurality's distinction. Whereas here you have a divided court and the majority agrees only on the outcome and not the ground for the outcome. The Supreme Court and this court have said that lower courts should follow the narrowest ground to which the majority of justices would have assented. As such, Harris should be interpreted narrowly to the situation that was, in fact, implicated by that case, which is that judicial fact-finding that triggers a modest increase in the minimum penalty does not violate the Constitution where there's no effect on the maximum penalty available. And Harris should not be extended to the situation where the judicial fact-finding substitutes a new sentencing range with an increased maximum as well as an increased minimum.
Would that argument, accepting that argument, require us to overrule the Jones case?
It would require this court to overrule, I believe, not only Jones, but several of this court's decisions.
That focus on the actual sentence imposed.
That focus on the actual sentence imposed. And this court has rejected Apprendi challenges in the situation that really is constitutionally indistinguishable from my case. So I recognize that this court, to rule for me on the constitutional issue, well, it would not have to anticipatorily overrule the Supreme Court in Harris. It would have to simply reinterpret Harris in the way that the Second and the Ninth Circuit case, Ninth Circuits have done in the Gonzales and the Velasco-Heredia cases that we've cited, this court would, however, have to overrule some of its prior decisions. And we recognize that stare decisis is an important guiding principle for the federal courts. But as the Supreme Court has said, it is not an inexorable command. The force of stare decisis is at its lowest when we're dealing with fundamental constitutional issues, as we are here. I see my time is up.
Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Nathalina Hudson. I represent the appellee, the United States, in this case. Your Honor, with respect to the constitutional issue that the defendant raised, this Court and the Supreme Court have repeatedly held that courts may find by a preponderance of the evidence facts that subject a defendant to the statutory mandatory minimum. This court has also held that where a defendant's sentence does not exceed the default statutory maximum for the crime for which he was convicted, there is no violation of Apprendi. Here, the maximum penalty for the defendant was 20 years. The defendant was sentenced to 10 years, well below the statutory maximum. Additionally, the court found by a preponderance of the evidence that the defendant was in possession of 15 kilograms of cocaine. Accordingly, the mandatory minimum applied under Title 21 U.S.C. Section 841B, and the defendant was subject to the 10-year mandatory minimum. Therefore, the defendant's constitutional rights were not violated. With respect to the second issue that the defendant raised, the Rule 35A issue, Your Honors, it is clear that Rule 35A was drafted to allow district courts to correct clear errors, and it is clear that in the advisory committee notes, the drafters intended an illegal sentence to be corrected and considered an illegal sentence a clear error.
So was Byerly wrong?
Your Honor, the Byerly case was not wrong, but it's distinguishable from this case. And it's distinguishable because in Byerly, the government missed several opportunities to correct the sentence. In Byerly,
the rule at that time said it could be invoked at any time, though, didn't it?
Yes.
That's a pretty wide invitation to invoke it.
Yes, Your Honor. The rule did provide that that any party could correct an illegal sentence at any time. But in this case, I think that because the government failed to raise an issue regarding the illegal sentence once the sentence was issued, and then the government did not file a cross appeal, and the only time that the government filed a Rule 35A motion after this court had affirmed the defendant's sentence and after the defendant filed a Rule 35B motion. And this court said specifically that because the government had missed so many opportunities to correct the illegal sentence, it could not then, after all these opportunities, file a Rule 35A motion. And that was the holding in Byerly.
It was 3 years later, right?
Yes.
But that's not the only import of Byerly as I read the case. It specifically applied the waiver doctrine in this context to the government and said that where the government affirmatively concedes an argument, essentially, at sentencing on the record, that a Rule 35A motion will not lie. And I understand the procedural context was all these years later and all these other opportunities to correct the situation and so forth, but that's in effect what the case says. And you know, is that still good law? And if so, why doesn't it apply here? Because this is a case where the government said no mandatory minimum on the record.
Your Honor, the case is still good law. However, I don't think that, however, it's the government's position that if you apply the decision, the defendant's interpretation of Byerly to other cases, essentially Rule 35A would be null and void.
It's not null and void in the case of an argument or a mistake that's simply, you know, a sin of omission as opposed to a sin of commission is the way that I look at it, where the governor just omits to raise something. It's like the difference between waiver and forfeiture. Something that's in the nature of a forfeiture that the government has overlooked at sentencing can be corrected by way of a Rule 35A motion if it otherwise meets the standard in the rule. But what we're talking about here is a waiver, an intentional relinquishment of an argument.
Would the waiver come in 7 days after the sentence?
Your Honor, I believe that, I think that...
Yes,
Your Honor. The waiver would apply after the 7 days. But this case is distinguishable because the following day, after making a mistake, the government filed its Rule 35A motion. It was well within the time limit set forth in Rule 35A. The government...
So you're arguing for an interpretation of Rule 35A that says basically an error, whether waived or forfeited, can be corrected within 7 days, but only a forfeited error after that point, or nothing after that point?
Your Honor, it's the government's position that where the parties have failed to file a Rule 35A motion within the time frame, and the government does, and a party doesn't file an appeal, that argument is waived. In this case, if we apply the ruling in Byerly to other situations, specifically if the ruling in Byerly was applied to the Gibson case, where the government, the defendant, and the district court all agreed that the defendant was subject to a 30-year maximum when he only pleaded to a 5-year maximum. If that were the case, then in that particular, if Byerly was applied to that case, the defendant would not have been able to file a Rule 35A motion under the defendant's interpretation of Byerly. But it's the government's position that if Byerly applied to the Gibson case and the defendant had filed a Rule 35A motion within a 7-day time period, then the defendant would not have waived his right to correct an illegal sentence.
I'd like to ask you a question about the sentencing under the preponderance of the evidence standard that Judge Gottschall sentenced this defendant. she listened to this witness who didn't have a very good memory and couldn't remember anything very specific about the quantity of drugs that this defendant was involved in. She made the comment that, well, this evidence is not very convincing or something to that effect. And the government said, well, it can be corroborated. So then they said, we've got some tapes of a conversation between the defendant and somebody else. But no, she never listened to the tapes, nor did she look at the transcript of those tapes. And eventually, I guess somebody gave her an affidavit from the complaint that she looked at, which was just some law enforcement person trying to summarize what he heard on the tapes. That strikes me. I mean, the reliability. And then she went through some further discussion of the matter and various aspects of it. But it seemed to me that this was a pretty unreliable process, and it's required to be reliable. You don't have to follow the rules of evidence, but you got to come up with reliable evidence. And this witness, of course, didn't have a very good memory, couldn't remember anything. And we didn't even have the either a transcript or some recording of the telephone conversation. So I'm not sure that that's sufficiently reliable to pass muster. Can you comment on that?
Your Honor, it's the government's position that the district...
The judge said from time to time, well, this isn't very illuminating, but it's the best I can get, or something to that effect. Excuse me, go ahead.
Your Honor, the district court did have an opportunity to hear from a reliable witness. At the drug quantity hearing, the cooperator, Juan Corral, testified that that the defendant was a preferred customer, and he was a kilo customer, and so he remembered the deals in which he that the defendant was involved with. And the cooperator testified that he remembered dealing with the defendant from February of 2002 until June of 2002. And the district court did have an opportunity to review the complaint affidavit prior to making its ruling. And what the district court said was...
I think it reviewed the affidavit after the ruling, didn't it?
No, Your Honor. In fact, the defendant's position is actually inaccurate. Prior to the court making a drug quantity finding, the government presented the court with a copy of the complaint affidavit when the government was refreshing Juan Corral's recollection. That was early on in the drug quantity hearing. And later on in the hearing, prior to the judge issuing her ruling, the court asked, how many discussions about transactions is the government actually able to prove with telephone calls? And this is at the separate appendix 101, and the government then directed the court's attention to specific portions of the complaint affidavit, and the government said, directing your attention to paragraph 90, we've got a call in which they're talking about five kilograms of cocaine. The court said, what other calls do you have? The government responded. Then we have what Mr. Corral testified to, which are the June 5th series of calls, and that's set forth at paragraphs 92 and 93, and that's in the separate appendix, page 191. And at the end of this questioning between the government and the district court, district court said, so the fact that there was a mid-May conversation that looks like a deal and an early June conversation that looks like a deal is sort of consistent with his basic once-a-month interaction with the defendant. And that was at the separate appendix 104. And during a later part of the hearing, after this, district court said, I think in this case I have to find by a preponderance of the evidence establishes that there was something more than 15 kilograms. And it was after the district court ruled that the defendant's attorney raised an issue about whether or not the district court listened to tapes. And it was at that point that they went through the complaint affidavit again. So the defendant's assertion that the district court did not have an opportunity to review the complaint affidavit prior to making its ruling is inaccurate and is not supported by the record.
Thank you. I think Ms. Hudson's glad you asked that question.
For the following reasons and the reasons set forth in the brief, we'd ask that this court affirm the district court's ruling.
Thank you. Mr. Andreozzi, the government took a little extra time. I'll give you a couple of minutes, 2 minutes to reply.
Well, I appreciate that, Your Honor, very much. The record is, I think, a little unclear as to whether the court actually looked at the 5 pages from the FBI agent's affidavit during the government's attempt to refresh the recollection of Juan Corral. There's nothing in the transcript that actually shows that the affidavit was handed to the court, although the AUSA does say, I have an additional copy, and so it may have been. But in any event, the salient fact is that there is no evidence in the record that any of the calls that were referred to in that 5-page excerpt from the FBI agent's affidavit represented transactions that ever took place. Now, Juan Corral, who was a party to the calls, was the government's only witness. Now, he should have known if these transactions actually took place, and he did not. He did not testify that any of them took place. The government refreshed his recollection as to a June 5th conversation, but he specifically said he didn't know if, in fact, the transaction actually took place. So there's no linkage between the FBI agent, who never testified, was never subject to cross-examination, his opinion or interpretation or impression about these phone calls. There's no linkage in the record between that and any finding as to the amounts of cocaine actually received by Clark. And that was the government's burden. Government's burden, even if you accept by a preponderance, the government's burden was to provide that linkage and show a basis for the amounts of cocaine actually received by Clark. And now there's been a, you know, the description of Corral's testimony is not entirely accurate here. You know, the government has just said that Corral testified that he dealt with Clark once a month. Well, he did say that at one point. He said, I dealt with Clark once a month. At another point, he said, perhaps it was less than once a month. At another point, he said, perhaps it was more than once a month. Well, that covers every conceivable possibility. And he had no memory of any specific transaction. And this is a witness, the government's witness, who said he had no records and he kept track of these transactions entirely in my head.
Mr. Andreozzi, thank you. And you took this case by way of appointment, did you?
I did, Your Honor.
The court appreciates your fine representation of your client, and thanks to all counsel in this case.
Thank you.
The case will be taken under advisement. We move to...